are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, October 19th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal and from the Grand Ballroom in the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. Ladies and gentlemen, I am in Las Vegas, Nevada, here at the Bellagio Hotel at the Mass Torts 2017 conference, which, if you are a longtime listener of this program, you know I do twice a year. I head to this conference in Las Vegas and talk to plaintiff's attorneys, trial lawyers, however you want to refer to them. But they are attorneys who go after often corporations, sometimes the government, trying to get redress for some harm that has been committed. And I'll talk more about that, but at the moment, sitting with me is Peter Mouget. He is an attorney with Levin Papantonio. Peter, welcome to the program. Let me just try and get
you. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Peter, I want to talk to you a little bit about opioids. It's I think this audience is fairly familiar with at least the broad strokes of what's going on with opioids in this country. I've also spoken to Burton LeBlanc, and I'm going to run that interview in a bit. This is a huge issue for the country. I mean, we're going to have record amounts of deaths
again
from opioid overdose. Broad strokes, give us a sense of how this crisis, how we got to this crisis, who the major players are, and then what folks here, and I imagine across the country, but from a legal perspective, what's going to be, how are these companies going to be held to account?
Well, how did we get here, I think, was the first part of what you started. And it's, when I first started looking at this, everyone wants to point to the doctors and the pill mills and the overprescribing. And there's definitely a lot of different ways that you can look at this. And there's definitely a lot of blame and a lot of fingers to point. We are focusing on the distributors, which, after a significant amount of analysis and investigation, I believe they were the ones, those companies, McKesson, Amerisource, Bergen, and Cardinal, big three, have 85% of the market share. Distributors, well, they claim...
Okay, wait a second. So just back up for one moment. So the big manufacturers of these drugs are like a Purdue, right?
That's right.
In particular. And then...
OxyContin, right.
They go to the distributors. What role... I mean, obviously, the role the distributors plays is to distribute these,
way too simple.
Right.
Here's what... And I was fascinated when I started looking at this. 1970 Controlled Substance Act. It's called the CSA. That was when the distributor role began to be defined. And it's much, much, much more important than just distributing the drugs in unmarked vans. What their job was to monitor, identify, report to the DEA, and halt, investigate suspicious shipments, which is high-frequency orders, numbers of pills into small communities, anything that was suspicious, any red flags. They were supposed to have very, very high-tech, sophisticated databases and monitoring equipment to curtail, to control the amount of pills that came into our communities. So not only did they not do that, they embraced the fact that the more pills that they sold, the more pills that they delivered into the communities, the more money they made. So at the end, at the bottom line of all this, is nothing different than any other case that we look at. And your opening talk about trial lawyers, what drives these issues over and over, and I don't care what industry it is greed. Bottom line, McKesson's CEO in 2016 made $160 million delivering one molecule off heroin to our communities in millions and millions and millions of pills. And so not only did they not do their job, but they embraced and marketed in these lower socioeconomic areas and pumped the pills in there to drive their profits. If you're to plot out their profits over, like on a graph, and you plot out deaths per capita, pills per capita, they're all on the same straight line
trajectory
upward. It's incredible. The more pills, the more money, and they just disregarded repeated warnings from the DEA saying, guys, here's what your role is. As we got into 2000, 04, 05, 06, educational campaigns, everything that these distributors needed to do their jobs, the DEA gave them. There's all kinds of programs and letters and PowerPoints and educational materials that went out. Here's what your job is. Here's what you're supposed to be doing. They paid it lip service and kept cashing checks. That's essentially what happened.
And my understanding is that they were fined, too, by the DEA, right? Because
largest fines ever.
And for them, I mean, this dynamic, and literally I hear this every single time I come to this conference, regardless of what the industry is, it's like those fines, that's
cost of doing business.
Cost of doing business.
Yes.
So that's, we just write, it's another line item. Electricity,
$250 million
labor,
you're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. And one of the biggest fines the DEA has ever imposed, $150 million, $250 million, depending on who you throw into the mix. Those were the level of fines. It doesn't deter. It doesn't work. It's not working. These fines don't work. It's cheap. It's too cheap.
And then we have also the big Washington Post story that that dropped just Sunday, that outlines how not only did the fines not work, but the response from these distributors and drug companies was turn around and basically lobby and successfully changed the law so that they had more latitude to do this type of thing.
And you and I have talked about this before. It's known as the revolving door. So, yes, they lobbied, but what the industry, and I don't care, it doesn't matter which industry, it's the securities, Wall Street, whether it's big pharma, they hire former DEA investigators, they meaning the big three or the industry. They'll hire all these regulatory investigators who are supposed to be cracking the hammer and keeping everybody in line. They hire them from the industry hire them from the regulators, right, and then bring them into the industry. And now they're sitting on the other side of the table. And that revolving door, they go back and forth. So the regulators know if I'm too aggressive, if the fines are too big, I put people in jail, like Rena Sissi, former DEA head that ran a lot of these investigations. He was on the 60 Minutes piece. He was pretty much ostracized because he was too aggressive,
right,
and run out of the industry. And they know if they're too aggressive on the regulatory side, they're not going to get the fancy job as the lobbyist or with the industry on the other flip side. So everything's soft. Kit gloves, cost of doing business, keep the fines low, no one goes to jail. Because if I'm too much of a pain in the ass, I'm never going to get the job on the other side with a big paycheck.
And so
that's a huge problem.
There is no, and then it's not a question of like the DOJ could theoretically go out. I mean, could the DOJ, is there a criminal theory to this case? Could the DOJ, could a state, a state attorney general say, look, you are, I get you getting fines, but you were so blatant in flaunting those fines that you've crossed into some type of criminal, I don't know what the theory would be, negligence, some type of homicide or something like that. Like, you should have known, based upon just the data that you had, that there was clearly mass addiction.
Well, let's take the numbers, and no one knows exactly how many pills were going into which communities and which pharmacies. The distributors were supposed to be reporting those numbers back to the DEA. Now, the DEA keeps it in a super secret database called ARCOS, and every single pill, starting from the manufacturer to the to delivery, is supposed to be tracked and monitored, and it's kept pharmacy by pharmacy, county by county, state by state. West Virginia is the only state that we've seen the numbers on, and there we've only seen summary data. They came out in a lawsuit, and the numbers in West Virginia are absolutely insane. 780 million pills, over a six-year period, 130 million on average, in a state that has 1.8 million people.
Right.
So if that doesn't put somebody on notice that the first time maybe you get a hall pass, guys, we got a problem. But to do this year after year, decade into another decade. And
I mean, do you think there is a criminal theory to this case?
I do. We added a RICO count. We added an organized corruption conspiracy claim, civil claim to our counts. But I think if you had a skilled U.S. attorney, I think you could put together and wait till the discovery comes out. If they're not going to do it now, I mean, they can convene a grand jury and get paper a lot easier than we can. They have a lot bigger stick than we do when it comes to getting paper.
So, all right. So I and I'm going to play this interview with Burton LeBlanc, and he and we cover some of this territory. But let me ask you this. Relative to my understanding is that the theory of the case, or at least in terms of like the plaintiffs, you're going to the counties, you're going to the municipalities,
right.
And there is an analog between the damages that you that you are pointing out to the tobacco strategy,
right.
Which is to basically say, we as a county slash state slash municipality are having to expend enormous amounts of resources to make sure that that we cover this stuff.
Right.
I mean, that we deal with this. We've got to deal with the idea of having this many addicts. Like, why? What is the difference between what happened with the tobacco settlement and this one?
There's a lot of overlap between the two. And I mean, the way we're looking at the damages, the taxpayers have borne a lot of the damage and harm caused by the distributors. So our damage model is, I call it kind of two buckets. One's retrospective. I mean, how much money have we spent on task forces? How much money have we spent on jails? All the kids that are being born addicted to opiates that we have to wean off in the court dockets that we have to deal with, child welfare dockets, the Narcan that they administer, the first responders, all of that you add up, and that's the retrospective damage model. And that's similar to tobacco in that tobacco also had Medicaid reimbursement to the states, paid for treating people with lung cancer and tobacco that the taxpayers bore the cost of that of those diseases. That's similar. But to me, the more important damage bucket or the piece is the prospective. And that's where I feel as a trial lawyer gets me up in the morning that I can make and drive policy change. So what we're trying to do on the prospective is to hold these distributors accountable and say, you got to clean up the mess. You have to provide the treatment for this generation of people that we now have addicted to opiates and heroin. We have to get the treatment facilities, the doctors, the fundings, because this isn't a 30-day, 60-day treatment program that you're in and out. These are people that have been addicted to heroin and opiates for years that need life skills to get back in to be functioning members of society. That's one. You have the task forces keeping us safe. You got to get those the police beefed up. Everybody knows the police forces are all undermanned and underfunded and don't have the. And then you also have the educational component of, kids can look and know that the medicine in mom and dad's medicine cabinet is just as dangerous as any drug or needle you get on the street. So those three pieces, prospectively, the health, the safety, and the educational piece, also similar to tobacco. There's a lot of overlap to tobacco.
My understanding is that some people feel that some of the tobacco funds did not necessarily get to the funds coming from the tobacco were not expended in a way that would necessarily benefit.
You're right. There is some criticism, and now what I do think is different, and I like this is a dramatic difference, is that tobacco is state driven, and here these are communities. I represent about 100 cities and counties, Indian nations across the country, and these are community-based solutions. We're working with local universities, local hospitals, and saying, you tell us what you need to fix the problem. So this money, what I hope to see is it goes right back into the communities, not fixing potholes, not putting in more red lights, but to actually go directly to the problem and build and create infrastructure to treat people. So I think that's tremendously different than tobacco, where this money goes
right
into the grassroots type efforts.
So, all right, lastly, let me ask you this. Like, how does this work from a practical standpoint? Because my understanding is that the plaintiffs that we're talking about could be anywhere from like the state of Arizona to a county in South Ohio. Yeah, there is there one case that sets, like, I understand in the context of the C8 litigation,
right?
There is the defendant. There's a pool of 3,500
right.
In that instance, in this one particular case, of potential or who are plaintiffs, I should say. The defendant chooses one case to try, then the plaintiff chooses one case to try, and that starts to give the parameters of what a settlement might look like. But how does that work in this context when you have sort of not apples to apples situations here? You have a county here that may be more expensive to do certain things because of the nature of the county, or a state. I mean, how does that work?
That happens a lot, and those cases often get consolidated in what's called an MDL or a multi-district litigation, which is what happened in C8 as well. But it's very common that the damages and the metrics are different. So we're working with math, PhD, statistical experts to help us put together models and create models that we are going to be able to take objective data points and develop a matrix. So it doesn't matter if you're in Kansas or New York, those matrix can be developed with objective data points. Doesn't matter where you are, but it does take into consideration the local costs, the local damages, okay. The amount of people, the number of pills, those kind of things are all going to be part
of
that matrix.
So it's sort of like the BP settlement, wherein if you were in a certain industry, if you were within a certain radius of the coastline,
exactly.
All these get into a matrix,
and that's
the way
very,
they develop
very
an algorithm.
Common like that everyone doesn't just fit into the same kind of hole that you have to account for the differences, and that's common. But you do have a core theme or central set of facts that does apply to everyone, which is what MDLs try to do. Create some economies of scale and some efficiencies in the court system, so you're not taking the same deposition hundreds or thousands
right.
of times, but those set of facts can apply to each one of these cases.
Hold on one second. Are we getting static still? Okay. All right, so let me ask you this before on a different topic. Your background is in, you have extensive background, I should say, in securities litigation.
Right.
And so we're looking at this devastation in Puerto Rico. And give us a sense of what was going on with Puerto Rico. I mean, I think people understand on some level, and I've spoken to people who specifically know the situation about Puerto Rico, where Puerto Rico was left in a hole because of a lot of different reasons in terms of their ability as a territory to generate the type of revenue they needed on the island to fulfill the state the government's objectives,
you know,
keeping the island in good shape. So then what happens there? What's going on with the debt and who owns it, and where are these pressure points coming from?
Well, that I love this conversation that's come up in the last couple of weeks. I think President Trump started with the offhanded comment that he made about we're just going to wipe it away with all your Wall Street friends. I think he was talking to a Fox reporter.
Yeah,
we're just
going
to wipe
Geraldo,
away the debt, all your friends, and kind of points to Wall Street. And
That didn't last very long.
Yes,
they walked it back the next day.
But it demonstrates how that's absolutely ridiculous. Now, do vulture funds, Wall Street firms own some of it? Of course they do. But the scary part about this hurricane, on top of what already was a horrific situation with the $72 billion in debt, is this, that most Puerto Ricans have material parts of their net worth in Puerto Rican paper. And we've created a little bit of this mess with this colonial relationship we have with the island. But there are some favorable tax treatments. The firms on the island pushed this debt where it was held in concentrated amounts, and it's illiquid, meaning a lot of it can't be sold other than to other Puerto Ricans. So if we were to erase the debt, now you have people that have lost their homes. 14% of the island has electricity. They don't have a drinkable water. It's a mess. I mean, just basic life, day-to-day services aren't there. And now we're saying, well, maybe we should just wipe away the debt that a material amount of Puerto Ricans have huge portions of their net worth. And they're looking at, because there's a...
So you're saying that there's a lot of Puerto Ricans who have bought these debt in the form of bonds?
Yes.
And they're bondholders.
Yes.
And
creditors.
If there's a default, it will hurt the people on Puerto Rico.
And there already have been defaults. So the payments are behind, and the governor has said that they're going to run out of money at the end of this month. So if they run out of money, the same people that just got crushed with this hurricane also, and they're counting on their bonds income to pay their bills, now their income stream is going to get shut off.
How widely dispersed are the ownership of those bonds? Is it concentrated in a few hands of wealthy
on the
people?
Island?
Yeah.
No, it's everything. I represent 300-400 individuals. It's everything from butchers, policemen that make $40,000-$50,000 a year, to we have clients that are worth $25 or $30 million. One thing that's consistent is that 70%, 80%, 90%, 100% of their debt, of their holdings, are in Puerto Rican paper. So if we were to shut off the income stream or wipe away the debt, the people
what
on
is,
the island.
So what's the solution to this? I mean, where does it come from? Because
let's go back to the same point we were talking about with the opiates for a second, as far as holding some of the companies liable. You had huge banks on the island, UBS, Santander, which is a Spanish bank, one of the biggest banks in the world, actively pitching and promoting issuing more debt. It's almost like I kind of analogize it. I have two kids in college. It's the, you know, putting money on credit cards and it just keeps expanding. Almost half of the $72 billion is interest. It's just pounding, stacking. So the problem is at this point, where are we going to go to fix, to get the money to pay the debt and to pay the income? And to be accountable. I mean, they have to chip into this pot. I mean, I've seen documents from senior management on the island actively promoting issuing more debt and how to structure it, could issue it and get very creative with the credit ratings just so they could earn more fees. And they knew that there were problems with how much debt, and they just kept, and they knew this was a house of cards that was going to matter of when, not if. So I think you collect some money from the banks. I'm waiting for the island to pursue some of the recommendations that were made. That's one pocket. I think the people that own the debt are going to need to take. I think it's inevitable, and I think some of it's going to have to be in the form of aid from the U.S. And
right.
It happened in Detroit. We've done it there. Why not do it on the island? It's going to be a multifaceted, it's going to be a year, it's going to be before this gets fixed.
Wow. Peter Mouget, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to us about both
things
today.
Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure.
All right, talk
Thanks
to you soon.
All right, folks, in a moment, I'm going to be talking hopefully to an attorney who has been working on equities. And hopefully he'll head here shortly. You know, just to remind people, we jump right in, but I mean, I think you just do issues that Peter Mouget has been talking about. Oh, here he is. I'll get to this. Mike, hi. We're live. Have a seat. So, Micah, stuff. Just tell me, you're from the Adkins firm in Birmingham.
That's right. So our principal office is in Birmingham, Alabama. In November, we will be moving our principal office from Birmingham to Brentwood, Tennessee, just outside of Nashville. And we also maintain offices in Dallas, Texas, as well as Houston, Texas.
Micah Adkins, tell me, my understanding is that you, you're working on the Equifax case, is that right?
That's right. So I work on Equifax cases, but probably in a little bit different aspect than maybe. So there have been dozens of class cases brought because of the data breach. However, I represent consumers who are victims of identity theft, mostly in individual cases.
And so, all right, but give us a sense, broadly, of when you represent people who are dealing with identity cases, like what's involved in that? Like, where does a lawyer come in that instance?
So you're asking a question that not only other lawyers ask me, but consumers direct. They don't know that there's lawyers out there like myself who represent identity theft victims. And in fact, they think maybe I need to go get a credit monitoring product, something like LifeLock, for example. But instead, where I come in is I represent consumers under one federal statute, generally. That's the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which was enacted first in 1970 and later amended in 2003 to help combat identity theft by providing rights and remedies for identity theft victims.
So, I mean, who provides those remedies? I mean, who's got liability in that situation?
Right. So Congress, when it amended the Fair Credit Reporting Act to combat identity theft, realized what happens once an identity theft victim's information is used and it's out there. And let's say, best case scenario, that the identity thieves get arrested. It's one out of 700 identity theft complaints ends in arrest. Very unlikely they'll even get arrested, let alone convicted. But those victims, their personal information is still out there. Their names, personal identifying information such as social, date of birth, items that more likely than not will never change, are bought and sold like drugs on the street. In other words, your personal identifying information is a commodity that can be bought and sold on the street. Congress realized, okay, let's say best case scenario, identity thief gets incarcerated, prosecuted. What happens to Mr. Identity Theft victim and the accounts that were opened up without his authorization or consent? Well, they come onto his credit report,
right,
at Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. And so what Congress said is, look, we have to give these identity theft victims special rights to help eliminate this collateral damage that's a result of the underlying identity theft. So one of the rights that consumers got was the right to get a free credit report if you're a victim of fraud. So you now can ask Equifax, give me my free credit report because I believe I'm a victim of fraud.
Right. And so we all have access to that. And so, so where do you come in here? So, they're obligated to give free credit reports, which, I mean, seems to me to be a pretty low bar for this stuff. I mean, so where, what do you do? You recoup from banks or from?
So here's how it works. And you're right, this low bar. I mean, we didn't ask Equifax, Experian, or TransUnion to store our most personal, private, financial information about us, our addresses, every address we've ever we never asked to opt in to this system. These companies elected, this is their business model. Let's harvest as much information we can and sell it. Big data. And so when these companies harvest your big data and their primary business is a report, it's not you as the consumer, as the customer. It's, hey, we want to sell your credit report to Bank of America.
Right.
Wells Fargo. Okay, that's our business model. That's how we make 90% of our revenue. Congress said, if you're going to do those things, you must have and follow reasonable procedures to assure the maximum possible accuracy of the reports that you sell. And if you don't, and you sell reports with false information, such as information that's a result of identity theft, and you knew it or should have known it, then you may be liable for a negligent or a willful violation. So if you're found liable, let's say, let's pick on someone else besides Equifax today, Experian, you're found liable for negligently violating the Fair Credit Reporting Act, or the FCRA as it's commonly referred to. Well, what can the consumer get? Well, they can get actual damages. Actual damages include monetary relief for things such as a lower credit score,
right,
a credit denial, unfavorable interest rate. It also provides for actual damages for emotional distress, mental anguish. As you can imagine, identity theft victims experience when they can't get this false, fraudulent information off of their credit reports.
So it would go down something like this. Somebody steals my information. Let's put aside for a moment the Equifax hack, because I just want to ask you about some of that litigation. I know you're not involved in it, but I know that you have some awareness of it. So my information's stolen. Somebody goes and opens up a couple of credit cards in my name, goes out, spends $30,000, $20,000, $10,000, whatever the credit limit would be for me, maybe $10,000. and but they do it on three or four different credit cards. They rack up $40,000 in debt. I'm not going to pay that. This goes on my credit rating as like the guy's a scofflaw, and I go to buy a car or buy a house to get a loan. They say your credit's just really bad, and I call these different Equifax and Innovis, I guess, and Experian, and I say, hey, that wasn't me. And they say, well, look, there's nothing we can do about it, or the bar for me to prove that is so high that I can't get there. That's when I can pursue them for damages. And so, like, how much of that is their business? Like, how much is, you know, dealing with how many times they screw up? Like, oh, we thought it was, you were Sam Cedar Jr., not Sam Cedar, you know, the third or whatever it is.
It's a big part of their business. It's such a big part of their business that the big three nationwide consumer reporting agencies, Equifax, Experian, TransUnion, have made a business decision to outsource the reinvestigation process. And I use the word reinvestigation because it's a term of art under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which says you credit reporting agencies, you are supposed to have already investigated this information before you put it on the consumer's file. So when you get notice of a dispute from a consumer, you must reinvestigate the disputed information.
So the they call it a reinvestigation to imply that they've actually investigated in the first place, when in fact they just got a note from a bank or
exactly. And so how much of their business is it? It's a big part of their business. It's such a big part that as a business decision, they have elected to outsource this work to other countries. For example, Equifax has used companies in the Philippines to do this type of work for them, where, by the way, in the Philippines, the native language is not English. It's a language called Tagalog. And for these workers there, they may not even have telephones at their desk, access to the internet, access to email, where if a consumer disputes something, that this person in the Philippines could actually communicate with the consumer and say, hey, can you give me some more information about that? Likewise, Experian.
But isn't there, I mean, and I guess maybe to a certain extent, we're hearing some of this out of like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and Elizabeth Warren in hearings. But it seems to me that, you know, this reinvestigation bar, aren't there standards that should be applied to these what constitutes a reinvestigation?
Well,
as opposed to like just, we put it on these folks' desks. I mean, they say a professional reinvestigation company. What more are we supposed to do?
So under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, Congress says it must be a reasonable reinvestigation. Hence, where a consumer advocate can come in and explain to a jury what is and what is not reasonable. And just as I pointed out, is it reasonable that these persons in the Philippines, their native language is not English? They don't have telephones on their desk. They cannot email anyone. They can't raise the flag to run something up the flagpole to say, hey, can someone else come in and take a look at this? So a jury gets to determine the answer to that question.
It feels like there needs to be some type of statutory reform for what these companies have to do. I mean, that seems to be like a lot, like to have to take each of these cases to trial, or do you spend your time just negotiating with the business affairs office of these places, or the legal remedy department or something like that?
Both. So you have in-house counsel, and all these, the big three have national counsel who defend them in these cases nationwide. And it is a business decision on what's paid to resolve these cases. And as one of my colleagues has said in the past, the credit reporting agencies would rather pay million-dollar verdicts than ever change their policies and procedures, because they're making too much money the way it is now.
Right. And so as long as they make it, it almost feels like one of those, when you call into customer service, you get that first person like, we can't possibly fix that for you. And if you stay on the line for long enough, they bump you up to someone else who will fix it for you. But they just need to play it out for as long as they can. They ultimately have probably some type of matrix in their office where they're like, this happened, this happened, this happened. This is worth between X dollars and X plus $10. And after 3 months, we settle. And because, you know, that's just, that'll be as long as we can string it out. And then we just move on. It's just
it's a cost of doing business. It's paying the toll.
Oh, my God. I keep hearing that here. It's depressing. So from the Equifax hack situation, I imagine this is not going to be the last time this happens. And I imagine that we're going to see more and more. Like, we don't know what percentage of those, 143 million files. Like, I know that when I plugged my thing in there after the arbitration clause was removed, they suggested that I might have a problem, and I just froze all my credit to all three of those things. A little bit of a pain, but I get the peace of mind. What happens? I mean, is there what is the fix for this?
So you used the word you froze your file after that.
I contacted all, I guess, four, right? I don't know what Innovis is.
So there is Innovis. Innovis is kind of coming onto the scene. They're building a database now. They will become the fourth nationwide consumer reporting agency. They've continued to acquire smaller consumer reporting agencies throughout the U.S.
What's the value to this is like a business-to-business type of industry, right? I mean, they're selling this. They're not selling it directly to the consumer. They're selling it to other businesses. What is the value to having four of these things?
So the value to the business customers could be price point. Perhaps this business may offer similar information at a lower price point. Hopefully, we would expect that the consumer reporting agencies would be braggadocious and say, buy a file from me. They're the most accurate reports out there. So perhaps by having a fourth player
it didn't even feel to me that like the business people necessarily, I mean, I guess the value of it being completely accurate is that they get a better assessment of what their risk is in terms of lending, you know, providing credit. But every time we have another one of these companies, it just feels like, oh, we're upping the chances that this information is going to get spread out across wherever.
That's so true. And, you know, we're kind of focusing on the big three, maybe soon to be the big four, inclusive of Innovis. However, there are over 300 consumer reporting agencies in the United States, 300 companies that you have probably never heard of. And these companies don't just sell credit reports. They sell consumer reports. And consumer reports are any reports that are provided to third parties to determine a consumer's eligibility for credit, employment, housing, or insurance. So there's companies out there like LexisNexis, for example, who is a consumer reporting agency also. There are companies out there like First Advantage, who sell background reports to determine consumers' eligibility for employment. There are companies out there such as RealPage who sell products for background screening, tenant screening, to see if someone's eligible to live in an apartment. And those are consumer reporting agencies,
right,
too. And they're also prone to the same types of inaccuracies that are plagued by the big three.
I mean, it seems to me, though, that those types of companies, and tell me if I'm wrong, don't necessarily provide information that could be weaponized by, like, well, I mean, it's weaponized in the context of housing, and there's another issue there, it seems to me. But that information, if it's, they lose it, if someone gets a hold of that information, that person who has stolen that information can't necessarily wreak the same amount of havoc that you could if, like, you have, or is the information materially the same? Social Security, the last three places you lived, maybe your mom's maiden name, and boom, off to the races.
The sky is the limit. Okay, what do you want to buy? and that's what you will be able to purchase from these companies. Email addresses, telephone numbers.
So where is the, where is that, that Consumer Credit Act from the U.S., from Congress, does that provide any structure for like an Equifax, like say like you have, you need to do X, Y, and Z to protect this information? I mean, it's only, it was updated, when did you say, in 93?
What's that? I'm sorry?
It was updated, the consumer.
The Fair Credit Reporting Act was last amended in 2003.
I mean, it just, even from then, the amount of technology that's out there, the requirements in terms of security, right? Like there doesn't seem to be, I mean, it's one thing to say like, okay, I have an action against you because your, the information you've compiled is inaccurate, and that has implications for me. But there doesn't seem to be any type of structure to say like, oh, incidentally, you need to spend X amount of dollars to keep that stuff safe. Like,
no, you're right. And so there is a provision that governs the storage and disposal of personal identifying information under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The Fair Credit Reporting Act was never intended to be a data breach law. There is no notification, for example, provisions under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. What's insane, too, is that not every state in the United States has a data breach notification law as we sit here today. And the fact of the matter is this, that while the Equifax data breach has governed lots of attention, people are very aware now of this data breach. These data breaches have been occurring for decades, and more likely than not, your personal identifying information is already out there. So earlier you mentioned, you know, well, I put a was going to freeze my file. That's exactly what everyone should be doing, because if you just think about this for one day, if every consumer in America put a freeze on their Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion file, because you have to do it at all three.
Yes.
You can't just do it at one.
I did Innovus too. I didn't even know
Excellent.
What it was. I'm
Excellent.
Glad. Tell me it's a legit company.
Excellent. They're I'm not legitimizing Innovus, but it
right.
is a it is a real company.
Okay.
But if everyone in America for one day put a freeze on their file for that one day, all four of those bureaus, 90% of their revenue would be zero. In other words, they would only have 10% of their daily revenue because all the Americans have put a freeze on it. Instead, the bureaus do not want you to do that, because as soon as you put a freeze on it, they cannot sell your report. And what the bureaus would prefer to do is sell you another product. Hey, buy credit monitoring.
Right.
We'll tell you when your identity has been stolen, right? You'll get a notice. Hey, someone just bought a
TV.
Do
they own those companies?
Yes, very much so.
Like, it occurred to me, you know, during this whole Equifax thing, that like, hey, how do I know that LifeLock isn't owned 75%? I mean, that's, you're getting it on both ends.
Well, so, and you bring up LifeLock, and so I have to share with you my view on LifeLock. Because it's a question that I'm asked everywhere that I go and speak about, hey, well, should I get a product like LifeLock? And I say, well, I was in New York City and I walked out of a building in Manhattan. Here's one of these billboard trucks. And it's got this guy's face on there. He's wearing a suit and tie, and it's got his name on there, and it's got his social security number and his date of birth. And I'm going, who in the world is this guy? I mean, this is not smart. We're in New York City and here's name, social, et cetera. Well, he's the CEO of LifeLock. And that was their one of their initial
right,
marketing pitches. Well, guess what? He had his identity stolen. Okay? It gets better. So the Federal Trade Commission begins to investigate LifeLock and says, look, we believe that your advertising is false, deceptive, misleading, because your product does not prevent identity theft. You just tell like people like, hey, there was an account opened up. So they got fined. They had to pay the toll, $12 million. There was a consent order entered with LifeLock. LifeLock didn't follow the consent order. Federal Trade Commission came back, this time $100 million. Okay. So there is no reason why any consumers ought to be purchasing a product like LifeLock. Instead, go out, put a freeze on your file, and don't worry about it.
I got to tell people, I did this right after the Equifax thing. It took me, I got to find the link. If you Google it, you will find there's a couple of like magazine articles that will basically just walk you through the process. It took me, I would say, in total, maybe 30 minutes, maybe. You just go in. Each one has a slightly different process. And it'll be, a pain if I'm like applying for a credit card or if I'm applying for a mortgage or something like that? I got to go and get like a one-day unfreeze from these places, and I imagine there'll be something involved in trying to coordinate the ask from who's giving me the loan to the, but I feel much better about it. I'm not, you know, like I. So okay, so let me just finish with this in terms of that Equifax breach. So what is there? I mean, could Equifax the suit? I imagine there's a bunch of probably I would imagine class action suits that are forming litigation to go after Equifax and saying you had an obligation to keep this stuff protected more. It seems to me like if it's illegal for somebody to steal my data, why isn't it illegal for someone to sort of just collect my data? Like, you know, like, I mean, what is the distinction between, I guess it's like, you know, maybe these hackers would be charged with hacking, but what if, I mean, that seems like a fine line. Like, this is information about me that I haven't authorized anybody. You know, like, Google does probably the same stuff, not necessarily the same information, but a whole mess of it. But I opt in to Google. I may not know, and that's a separate question as to what, you know, how opaque that is. But I never, ever did anything that authorized Equifax. You know, there was no little checkoff box. There was none of it. So why are they authorized to collect my information?
I guess, in other words, so fundamentally, how is Equifax any different than the hackers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're coming into the computer system, the hackers, and getting the information, and Equifax is getting it from wherever they get it from. How is that any different? I don't know that it is, because you're right. None of us checked a box to opt in to Equifax's database. None of us checked a box to opt in to Experian or TransUnion's. And I do think that it is a major privacy issue in this country that should be addressed. Europe has done this and is continuing to do this as far as privacy laws there, which are much more stringent. And I think that what we've seen in the United States, the trade-off has been nowhere else in the world can you get credit as quickly as you can in the United States. And the reason why you can do that is because you can walk into a Best Buy, talk to the person behind the counter, and see what you get approved for credit-wise by giving them your name, address, and a Social Security number. Within 30 seconds, they turn around and tell you whether you're approved, and if so, for what amount. And that's from the industry side, the trade-off is, look, this is the American credit system. Equifax has been in the United States since 1900, doing this business.
Weird.
And in the old days, they had file cabinets. In local towns, they had offices throughout the United States where they actually had a file cabinet with a file with your name on it. And storekeepers would come down the street and ask, hey, do you have a file on Micah? Well, yes, we do. Let's pull it up. And they'd pull out the file and they'd tell them, hey, here's what other storekeepers' experience has been with Micah. You make a decision whether you do business with them.
Interesting. Well, Micah Atkins, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. Enjoyed it.
All right, folks. And so what we're going to do now, I think, is we're going to let's play. What do you guys think? Back in, are you still with me on the video?
Yeah, we're still here. We're good. You're looking at different sound?
Yeah, all right. We can do that. I have one other interview from Bert and LeBlanc about the opioids, but maybe we'll play that tomorrow as well. And anticipating a couple other interviews, we'll see. It's
before we go,
you know, I walk
fun
around.
House.
Yeah, I think we'll do that. I mean, I just want to reiterate to people about, particularly in this day and age, one where the regulatory function of our government is, I think, under unprecedented assault. The importance of the work that people do here. It's very strange for me because I was... But I think for people who've listened to this program for a long time, we had Fran Lebowitz on, and she's way overdue to come back on. But we were talking about when it was that we felt money became an ascendant value, or I think it's probably always been an ascendant value in this society, but had sort of moved into overdrive. And she, in what was probably one of the most exciting moments of my radio career, said when lawyers began to advertise, because I had always felt that, and the reason why I had felt that is having been raised by an attorney in whose vast majority of the family members were attorneys. When lawyers were allowed to advertise, so they took place in the early 70s, it was like a day of mourning in my house. Like, I remember it as if there was, you know, just literally like it was a wake.
Like the civic obligation of being a lawyer is just done, and now it's just another, like being a used car salesman. Is that what was going on?
I think that's what it must have been. I mean, I don't even know if I was old enough to understand what was going on. Like, it was just, it was as if something horrible happened in the family, you know, that you would, if it was a piece of fiction, it would be like, oh my God, someone died in a horrible, tragic, or someone in the family killed somebody else in the family.
Whoa.
But it was, in fact, just lawyers could advertise.
How long was it after that happened that your father's firm started advertising?
My father's firm, I don't think, ever did.
Oh, wow, nice.
I mean, it's possible they, but they didn't do that type of work. They're, you know, the firm, they didn't do that type of work. And so I grew up with a predisposition to look askance at trial lawyers and personal injury lawyers and whatnot. And I am agnostic on the question of personal injury lawyers. I think there's, in any industry, there's good ones, there's bad ones, that type of thing. But, and many of the people here, they come to this conference because maybe they're practicing personal injury law, and then they learn about how to get involved in these large mass torts cases and multi-district litigation cases, etc. And there's just a bizarre mix of people here that range from being affiliates who feed cases to these firms that are actually working on them, to those lawyers that we sit down with here who are actually doing those cases. Over the years, I've interviewed Rosa Parks' attorney here. I think it was 2 years ago, maybe last year actually at this time, interviewed a woman who had sued Mike Pence. Maybe it was 2 years ago. I don't even know if he was the VP at the time. Sued Mike Pence in his role as Indiana state governor for cutting off the payments to foster parents of people who were foster parenting kids with disabilities. Needed to cut the payments. So there's a real mix here. But like, if you get even just, you take even a 10,000 foot view of this, the work that the people here do end up being used in like the mortgage cases that attorney generals will follow. I mean, these people function both as like deputies to private deputies, almost like bounty hunters, I guess, for district attorneys, attorney generals across the country. But also step in when, you know, the regulatory authority is not enough. This case, this question of opioids, is just sort of, it's stunning. There's no mechanism beyond fines to stop a corporation from pumping out a highly addictive substance that definitively, at some point, they were fully aware of the implications of everything we were doing. They were aware of the death and destruction they were causing. And there was simply no mechanism other than these fines. And then we saw that that mechanism assaulted, as outlined in that Washington Post story. But that mechanism is not enough. It's simply not enough. And what the trial attorneys end up coming in and doing is basically taking a bigger piece out of that company, so that it's not just the cost of doing business. It could be business ending. Certainly, you know, it implicates the way that other companies do business. But, you know, I don't know if we'll talk about C8 again. My understanding is there's another there's other cases, but C8 is that chemical where Mike Papantonio was the lead litigator in a case that Dow Chemical ended up being on the hook for, I think, almost $1 billion, maybe $1.5 billion, because they just willfully dumped an incredibly toxic substance into the ground and knew that they weren't supposed to. It was just cheaper. And they found documents, Papantonio's firm does, because what these big companies do is they dump hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pages of documents in discovery, and they just sit back and go, like, good luck with that stuff. And Papantonio's firm is so large that they say thank you, and then they actually go through them, and it ends up Papantonio is showing people, showing the attorneys from these companies documents that had come from the company that the company didn't even realize was there. And so, you know, Dow, I think, has to fold into DuPont. And the calculation next time someone says we're going to dump this stuff into the water is, at the very least, they're going to take into account, ooh, this could be expensive for us down the road. And, you know, last time, I think in the spring I was here, there was a lawyer who was getting an award from the conference who was from Brooklyn. And he told the story of a case that he won against the city of New York that he didn't anticipate it would do this, but it ended up so that every playground in the city of New York now is lined around the playground with a sort of a, I don't know if it's a rubber or like a some type of rubber mat, so that when kids fall off of these things, they're not breaking their limbs.
So no more freedom. And
no more freedom. Freedom has been completely impinged. And so, but it, you know, and it's one of those things that, when you know, you're a parent, your kid's playing on the thing, you're always like, wow, thank God this is here. And then you find out the reason why it's here is not because somebody made an affirmative decision to do this in the absence of, it is because...
Oh, hell no.
I mean, human nature is human nature. They're, you know, people are going to get away with what they can get away with. And, or maybe it doesn't occur to people. Who knows? But in this instance, you know, I don't know how many kids didn't break their arms or legs over the past 30 years that this was all in there. But, you know, this attorney was like, I was just, you know, some guy, and I materially impacted the lives of hundreds of thousands of kids, millions of kids maybe in New York over the course of 30 years playing on playgrounds. So, but that's why I enjoy coming here. And then, of course, in the fun half, I will talk about how I have, we're going to be building another wing to the Majority Report studio based upon my projected winnings. I haven't had actual winnings yet, but my projected winnings are extremely high. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support of this program that makes it possible. You can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And as our way of saying thank you, we say, hey, why don't you enjoy the fun half with us? Which is super fun. And Michael will be controlling the calls from the studio. So you will call into the system, and I will bring them up. Yes. And I have IMs on my machine.
You got IMs on your machine.
So we'll be taking...
Okay.
Yeah, 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me through the app. It's the best place for now. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, if you buy your crap from Amazon, do so through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. We get a kickback. You will notice no difference. You can use a mechanism in which would allow you to go to that link every time. You know what that's called. Oh, I lost my place in this book. I got to get one of those things that would allow me to do that. And also, Michael, who did you have on Tuesday night? I was on a plane involved in a really lame Twitter fight because I was so bored.
Sorry, I was moving.
Michael was moving stations.
Sorry about that. Who did I had on Tuesday?
Yeah.
Oh, on my show. I had on Nando Vila, who's a producer and host at Fusion on Catalonia, the EU, and socialism. And then
I've seen some of his vids.
Yeah, he's pretty good. And then I had on Mike Hanna, who's really legendary journalist. He does UN for Al Jazeera now, and we went into the Iran deal. And at the end, he's like an incredibly distinguished journalist, right? He's like CNN Jerusalem bureau chief, did stuff. He's been covering this stuff since the 80s. And he was explaining Trump and how he's thrown the UN into disarray and what's happening in Iran. And I've interviewed him several times now, so I know he does have a sense of humor, but I still try to kind of mind my P's and Q's with him. But at the end of the interview, I said, Mike, in the nature of transparency, who do you think won this interview? And he's like, well, adopting the Trump position, you're a loser, Michael. And I think that might have been my most... Did you hear that drop?
Yes, that's awesome.
You're a loser, Michael.
So I think that was one of the greatest moments I've ever had.
That's your show slogan, isn't it? It's like in italics underneath. No? All right. So, folks, you can check out the Michael Brooks show on iTunes or on YouTube. All right, quick break. Right back with the fun half.
Sad.